No one wore normal-soled shoes. They were all tottering on thick platforms. All Hallows' Eve, I thought. Raymond returned from the bar with a plastic pint of beer for himself and, without having asked, something paler for me. "Cider!" I shouted over the din. "But Raymond, I don't drink cider."
"What do you think Magners is, you daft bin?"
he said, nudging me gently with his elbow. I sipped reluctantly. It wasn't as nice as Magners, but it would do. It was too loud to converse, so I scanned the room. The stage was small and raised only a metre or so from the floor. When I came back here, assuming Johnny Lohman would be standing front and centre, he'd be able to see me easily, even if I were forced to position myself halfway back in the crowd. Cupid does, presumably, need a tiny nudge sometimes. The audience started making a collective animal noise and surged forward. We stayed where we were. The musicians were now on stage and had begun to play. I put my hands to my ears, unable to believe what I was hearing. Without exaggeration, it could only be described as the cacophonous din of hell. What on earth was wrong with these people? The singer alternated between screaming and growling. I couldn't bear it a moment longer and ran upstairs, rushing outside into the street, panting and shaking my head like a dog in an attempt to rid my ears of the sound. Raymond followed shortly afterwards. "What's wrong, Eleanor?" he said, looking concerned. "Are you okay?" I wiped the tears from my face.
"That wasn't music. That was, oh, I don't know, the horror, Raymond, the horror."
Raymond started to laugh, proper belly laughs, for which he was very well equipped, until he was actually bent over and struggling to breathe.
"Oh, Eleanor," he said, wheezing. "I knew you weren't a fan of grindcore. What the fuck were you thinking?"
He started giggling again. "I just wanted to see the venue, listen to a band," I said. "That such sounds could exist, it's beyond human imagining." Raymond had recovered himself.
"Aye, well, what is it that they say? Try everything once except incest and Morris dancing. Maybe we should add death metal to the list, eh?"
I shook my head. "I have literally no idea what you are talking about. None of those words make any sense," I said. I took several deep breaths until I felt almost calm again. "Let us retire to an inn or public house, Raymond, a quiet one, and please allow me to buy you some beer in recompense for this wasted evening."
"Oh, wasn't he wasted, Eleanor?" he said, shaking his head. "Your face! This is one of the best nights I've had in ages."
He started to laugh again, and much to my surprise, I found myself joining in. It was amusing that I had so comprehensively misunderstood the genre of music being performed. I had a lot to learn about music, I realised, and it would be important to do so in order to interact appropriately with the musician. "Have you heard of Johnny Lomond and the Pilgrim Pioneers?" I asked him. He shook his head. "Why?" he said. I took out my phone and navigated to the singer's webpage. Raymond scrolled down for a few moments, reading the text, then popped in his earphones and listened for a minute or two.
"Sounds shit,"
he said dismissively, handing me back my phone. "This from a man in a skull sweatshirt."
"Really?" I said. "He's got a standard issue beard, an expensive guitar he doesn't know how to play, and a fake American accent. Trying to make out he's from the South. Aye, right, South Lanarkshire,"
Raymond said, blowing smoke out of the corner of his mouth with a smirk. I wasn't sufficiently well informed to be able to agree or disagree, so I kept quiet. Either way, I needed to know at least a few salient facts about popular music, and, recent aberrant opinions aside, I suspected that Raymond was my best source. "Do you know much about music, then?" I asked as we walked towards a pub which Raymond assured me was quiet.
"A proper old man's pub," he said, whatever that was.
I guess," he said. "Wonderful," I said. "Now please, tell me everything." Chapter 25. It was the day of the concert.
Everything was ready. I looked the part. I felt the part. I would speed up time if I could to get to tonight more quickly. I'd found a way to help me move forward at last, a way to replace a loss with a gain. The musician. It was luck that he'd come along at precisely the right time. It was fate that, after tonight, my Eleanor pieces would finally start to fit together. How exquisite the anticipation. A pain, a churning pain inside me. I did not know how to assuage it. I felt instinctively that vodka would not work. I would simply have to bear it until we met, and that was the nature of this peculiar, blissful burden. Only a little longer to wait now, a matter of hours. Tonight I was going to meet the man whose love would change my life. I was ready to rise from the ashes and be reborn. Bad Days. Chapter 26. I am naked, lying on the floor, looking at the underside of the table. The pale wood is unvarnished and there is a faded stamp bearing the imprint "Made in Taiwan." Some important items are lined up on the tabletop. I can't see them, but I can sense them above me. This hideous table, blue melamine top, rickety legs, the varnish scraped off in places by decades of careless use. How many kitchens has this table been in, before it found its way to me? I imagine a hierarchy of happiness. First purchased in the 1970s, a couple would sit here, dining on meals cooked from brand new recipe books, eating and drinking from wedding china like proper grown-ups. They'd move to the suburbs after a couple of years. The table, too small to accommodate their growing family, passes on to a cousin newly graduated and furnishing his first flat on a budget. After a few years, he moves in with his partner and rents the place out. For a decade, tenants eat here, a whole procession of them. Young people, mainly, sad and happy, sometimes alone, sometimes with friends, lovers. They'd serve fast food here to fill a gap, or five stylish courses to seduce, carbohydrates before a run and chocolate pudding for broken hearts. Eventually the cousin sells up and the house clearance people take the table away. It languishes in a warehouse, spiders spinning silk inside its unfashionable rounded corners, blue bottles laying eggs in the rough splinters. It's given to another charity. They gave it to me. Unloved, unwanted, irreparably damaged. Also the table. The things are all laid out. Painkillers, 12 packets of 24 tablets prescribed and carefully hoarded. Bread knife, hardly used, shark's teeth ready to bite. Drain cleaner, cut through all blockages, even hair and grease, also flesh and internal organs. This table. This table where I have never sat with another person and shared a bottle of wine. This kitchen, where I have never cooked for anyone but myself. Lying here on the floor corpse-like, I can feel spiky crumbs sticking to the bare backs of my arms, my buttocks, my thighs, my heels. It is cold. I wish I were a corpse. Not long. Not long now. All of the empty vodka bottles are in my sightline, dropped on the floor when they were finished. I ought to feel ashamed that someone will find the place in this state, but I feel nothing. Eventually my body will be removed and industrial cleaners will be dispatched, I suppose. The flat will be relet. I hope the new tenants will be happy here. Leave some traces of love in the walls and the floors and the gaps around the windows for the next inhabitants. I have left nothing. I was never here. I don't know how long I have been lying like this. I don't recall how I ended up on the floor of the kitchen or why I am naked. I reach for the bottle beside me, anxious about how much remains, instantly relieved at its heaviness. This is the last one, however. When this bottle is done, I have two choices. Get off this floor, get dressed, and go and buy more. Or kill myself. Actually, either way, I'm going to kill myself. It's simply a case of how much vodka I drink before I do it. I take another big mouthful and wait for the pain to be released. When I wake up again, I'm in the same place. 10 minutes have passed, or 10 hours, I have no idea. I move into a fetal position. If I can't be a corpse, then I wish that I was a baby, curled up in some other woman's womb, pure and longed for. I move slightly, turn my face towards the floor and vomit. It is, I notice, clear and streaked yellowish-green. Alcohol and bile. I haven't eaten for some time. There are so many liquids and substances inside me, and I try to list them all as I lie here. There is earwax, the yellow pus that festers inside spots, blood, mucus, urine, feces, chyme, bile, saliva, tears. I am a butcher shop window of organs, large and small, pink, grey, red. All of this jumbled inside bones, encased in skin, then covered with fine hair. The skin bag is flawed, speckled with moles, freckles, little broken veins, and scars, of course. I think of a pathologist examining this carcass, noting every detail, weighing each organ. Meat inspection. Fail. It is incomprehensible to me now that I could ever have thought that anyone would love this ambulant bag of blood and bones. Beyond understanding. I think of that night. When was it? 3 days ago? 4? And reach for the vodka bottle. I retch again, remembering. The day had not augured well from the start. Polly the plant had died that morning. I'm fully aware of how ridiculous that sounds. That plant, though, was the only living link with my childhood. The only constant between life before and after the fire. The only thing, apart from me, that had survived. I'd thought it was indestructible. Assumed it would just go on and on. Leaves falling off, new ones growing to replace them. I'd neglected my duties these last few weeks, too busy with hospitals and funerals and Facebook to water her regularly. Yet another living thing that I'd failed to look after. I wasn't fit to care for anyone, anything. Too numb to cry, I dropped the plant into the bin, pot, soil and all, and saw that throughout all these years it had been clinging on to life only by the slenderest, frailest of roots. Life was so very precarious. I already knew that, of course. No one knew it better than me. I know how ridiculous this is, how pathetic, but on some days, the very darkest days, knowing that the plant would die if I didn't water it was the only thing that forced me up out of bed. Still, later that day I'd come home from work, put the rubbish out, dressed up, made myself go out to the concert. I went alone. When I met the musician, I needed it to be just me and him. No distractions, no complications. I needed to make something happen, anything. I couldn't keep passing through life, over it, under it, around it. I couldn't go on haunting the world like a wraith. And things did happen that night. The first thing was the realization that the musician simply didn't know I was there. Why on earth had I ever thought that he would? Stupidity, self-delusion, a feeble connection to reality? Take your pick. The shame. I had stood right at the front, ridiculously trussed up in new clothes, clownish makeup, tottering on heels. When he came on stage, I was close enough to see the double knot he'd tied in his shoelaces, the strand of hair that flopped over his eyes, his hands on the guitar, fingernails carefully manicured. The lights were bright on him and I was in darkness. But he would see me, nonetheless. If it was meant to be, and surely it was, then he would see me, the way I'd seen him all those weeks ago.
I stood still and looked up at him. The band started to play and he opened his mouth to sing. I could see his teeth, the soft pinkness of his palate. The song finished and another began. He spoke to the crowd, but he did not speak to me. I stood and waited throughout another song and another. But still he didn't see me. And gradually, as I stood there beyond the lights, the music beating off my body without getting in and the crowd unable to permeate the layer of aloneness that encases me, I began to realise the truth. I blinked again and again as though my eyes were trying to clear the view before them, and it crystallised. I was a 30-year-old woman with a juvenile crush on a man whom I didn't know and would never know. I had convinced myself that he was the one, that he would help to make me normal, fix the things that were wrong with my life. Someone to help me deal with Mummy, block out her voice when she whispered in my ear, telling me I was bad, I was wrong, I wasn't good enough. Why had I thought that? He wouldn't be drawn to a woman like me. He was, objectively, a very attractive man, and could therefore select from a wide range of potential partners. He would choose an equally attractive woman, a few years younger than himself. Of course he would. I was standing in a basement on a Tuesday night, alone, surrounded by strangers, listening to music I didn't like because I had a crush on a man who didn't know and would never know that I existed. I realised I had stopped hearing the music. There he was on stage, pressing guitar pedals and saying something trite about touring as he tuned. Who was this stranger? And why had I chosen him of all the men in this city, this country, the world, to be my saviour? I thought about a news story I'd read the previous day. Some young fans holding a tearful vigil outside a singer's house because he'd cut his hair. I'd laughed at the time, but wasn't I behaving like them? Acting like a love-struck teenager who writes fan letters and purple ink and etches his name on her school bag? I didn't know the man on stage before me, didn't know the first thing about him. It was all just fantasy. Could anything be more pathetic? Me, a grown woman? I told myself a sad little fairy tale, thinking that I could fix everything, undo the past, that he and I would live happily ever after and Mummy wouldn't be angry anymore. I was Eleanor, sad little Eleanor Oliphant with my pathetic job, my vodka and my dinners for one, and I always would be. Nothing and no one, and certainly not this singer who was now checking his hair in his phone during a bandmate's guitar solo, could change that. There was no hope. Things couldn't be put right. I couldn't be put right. The past could neither be escaped nor undone. After all these weeks of delusion, I recognised, breathless, the pure, brutal truth of it. I felt despair and nausea mingled inside me, and then that familiar black, black mood came down fast. I slept again. When I woke, my head was empty. Finally, of all thoughts except physical ones. I am cold. I am shaking. Decision time. I decided on more vodka. When I got to my feet, slow as evolution, I saw the mess on the floor and nodded to myself. This was a good sign. Perhaps I might actually die before I needed to choose one of the methods laid out on the table. I took a tea towel from the hook. A present from Hadrian's Wall, it said. It had a centurion and an SPQR sigil on it, my favourite. I used it to wipe my face and then dropped it on the kitchen floor. I didn't bother with underwear but simply pulled on the nearest clothes from the bedroom floor, the outfit I'd been wearing on Tuesday night. I stuck my bare feet into my Velcro work shoes and found my old jerkin hanging in the hall cupboard. I didn't know where the new coat was, I realised. My bag, however, needed to be located. I recalled that I had taken the new black handbag with me that night. It only had room for my purse and keys. Keys were on the shelf in the hall where I always put them. I found the bag in the hall too, eventually,
dropped in a corner next to my shoulder.